One piece that has really stuck struck with me through my life, and it's a speech that the former president of the US, Teddy Roosevelt, gave in France in 1909. It was entitled Citizen in the Republic. What has become famous as being known as the man in the arena. So I'm just going to read it out very quickly. It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly. So this place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to What Makes You Tick. And to, in keeping with the theme of bringing on various people that motivate me, inspire me, and are super, super important in my life, today's guest is one of my best friends in the world. Brian Cahill is his name. Now, Brian and I go back years. Brian is married to my lovely cousin, Sarah. And Sarah thankfully introduced us. And ever since then, we've been joined at the hip. So, Brian, welcome on board. How are you keeping, pal?
Yeah, good, man. It's great to be on.
Good, good, good. Now, don't let the nerves get the better of you. Pretend you're having a few pints. Relaxing, we're just having
maybe,
a chat.
Maybe I am.
maybe you are. But listen, the reason I asked you on to the podcast today is there's a number of things, I suppose, in your life that I'm super impressed by, and there's a number of things that have happened in both our lives that we've been there for each other at different stages, right? And we've been kind of supportive, and we've built a great friendship, and to say the least, we've gone to battle together. Now, not in real terms, in terms of what you do as a job, but definitely in terms of a personal view. But yeah, I asked you on because you are married to the beautiful Sarah, but also father of my goddaughter Lucy and Ellen, and who are two remarkable kids. And I've kind of grown up with them and grown up with you a little bit over the last, say, 15 years or so. And yeah. But on top of that, then you're also working for the Irish Army, and you have been deployed on a number of different tours along the way. And there's been challenges, obviously, with that, having a young family, going on tour, working in the Irish Army, and all the elements that come with that. But I think your story is remarkable. I think your the way you kind of conduct yourself in life, you're always trying to learn. You're always trying to push the boundaries a little bit to see what else you can do. You're constantly doing a course, and you're constantly learning to try and improve yourselves and improve your skills. And yet you're a fantastic dad, and you're a brilliant friend. I suppose it would be lovely to just get a little bit of an essence of how you found your way into the army of all careers, because in fairness, the stuff that you guys go through from the stories you've told me is incredible. How you found yourself into the army? You're after 20 years now of a career you
doesn't
chose.
Make me feel old at all.
A young fella.
Yeah, a lifetime ago. I suppose I was lucky enough to have, growing up, my dad was a scout leader for years before I was born in Cork. And when I came along, it was something he was quite adamant and supportive for me to get involved with. So it was the love of the outdoors started from a very, very young age. Like, you know, so as soon as I get into the Cubs, Scouts, Beavers, Ventures, you know, hiking, field craft, just being outside. And for as long as I can remember, like, I grew up, you probably wouldn't do it now, but I remember watching, like, as a kid, all the old Second World War movies, Vietnam movies, as a 6 and 7 year old, all the old black and white stuff. And I just thought it was cool. And to be honest, it's probably maybe a bit cliched, but I actually can't remember kind of wanting to do anything else.
Yeah, it's gas, isn't it? Like those movies you couldn't show now to 6 and 7 year olds.
No, sit down there for 2 hours, watch something on D-Day. Like.
Yeah, imagine it. But yeah, it is like, is that, you think, was that the kind of the catalyst for you to kind of go down that road of the army? Or was it a case of like, so obviously your dad's experience was influential, but like there's a big jump from going from the scouts into the army.
Absolutely. And like I've no, in the recent past anyway, family members who've had any military service. So I suppose it was secondary school when I really started to explore it. So then when I was old enough, I joined what was then the FCA. So I was still in secondary school, and I had a couple of friends in school, and their older brothers were in. One of them actually was a couple of years ahead, had just got a cadetship into the Air Corps. And it was at that point I started, well, oh, do you know what? This is part-time. Do you know, maybe I could learn something from here, dip the toe in the water. And when I think about it, like it was crazy. Like we joined over in the barracks, in Colbrew Barracks in Rathmines. But growing up at Coolock in Dublin, it was the opposite side of the city. And with McKee Barracks being closer, I could have got one bus out to McKee, but I ended up having to get a bus into town, a bus out to the Brewer. So I kind of tested my resilience to stick it in quick. Once I got in,
You had to deal with a different accent as well, I'm sure.
Different accents. I was coming in from the wilds of the north side. But I met some amazing people, and I was very lucky that the 20th Infantry Battalion, it's kind of long gone now, but it was the oldest FCA unit in the country at the time. But it was hugely integrated, way ahead of its time, with the permanent infantry battalion in the unit, the 2nd Battalion. So we got huge exposure to training. Yes, it was part-time, but you never got you hear the old, but kind of the FCA was the butt of a lot of jokes, you know, but this was a fairly professional outfit that it wasn't the case you go in for two nights a week, a Tuesday and a Sunday, and kind of have the crack with the lads and that's it. You had lots of crack, but it was still taken seriously. And I suppose it was at that point, then, you know, talking to the career guidance counselor, my history teacher, Mr. O'Brien, remember chatting to him, and he'd come in and do a careers day, he'd come in and give a presentation. He was doing a civics class. I was talking about like citizenship and service and what that meant, and then everyone had to come in and kind of give a talk about what they'd like to do. And it was four of us in a couple of classes came in who had kind of at that stage made up their mind about taking that leap into the military service straight from school.
Wow, it's mad, isn't it? Like that's whatever length, you're like young fella taking that leap and not knowing that it was going to be the next two decades or over two decades, like, you know, because like,
to be honest, like coming out the gates, and I'm sure, look, I'm probably jumping the gun here with your question. Like it was the test of adversity straight away, because I'd be the kind of person that I kind of, once my mind just said, like, okay, this is what I'm doing. And all the focus into that, you do. It wasn't the full army fitness test. It was a shortened kind of an assessment test rather than a fitness test. I was training for that, not a bother, and was doing the interviews, no problem. And I actually fractured my ankle, or dislocated my ankle in the Phoenix Park doing the fitness test. So I tripped on a curb, and whatever way I landed, my right ankle just kind of dislocated. And so that was the start of the journey. And I was brought back in, and I got to know him afterwards in service, but the captain running the car, I kind of wasn't expecting this. He was like, well, I don't know what to tell you. You haven't made it. I was like, okay. And he was like, and we should probably get you to a doctor. And it turned out to be very simple as dislocations go.
Yeah.
But that was my first step on the ladder of adversity.
Yeah. And it is funny, isn't it? Because over the years as well, like you've gone down a number of different training courses, and unfortunately different injuries that kind of became a theme at different points in your career, right? Injuries were setting you back, and maybe we can get onto that, but maybe there's like talking about the kind of the initial setup and deciding that you're going to go into the army. Now where we're talking, you're currently deployed right now, so maybe tell people where you are and what you're up to now.
Yeah, I'm in Syria. Again, this is my fourth tour of duty out here. So I'm on the Golan Heights in Syria. I'm working for the UN mission known as UNDOF. It's the Disengagement Observer Force. So I've been very lucky up until now to have a number of tours with the Irish Defence Forces, as in leading troops, working with the Irish troops based here, whereas this time now I'm here for 12 months working in the mission headquarters. So I'm away from the Irish Soups in a way, it's the multinational headquarters, and I'm currently the senior staff officer for media and PR. So I kind of control all the products that the mission puts out in a, what I'm sure people understand is a very sensitive operating environment.
Yes, yeah, and I know we won't get into detail, otherwise you'll find me and you'll do your famous...
link will just go down.
Yeah, but it is mad because like you're there now for a year this time, whereas previous tours, it's 6 months, right?
It's generally 6 month tours, yes. I'm halfway through.
So what number is this in terms of tours that you've been on?
This is seven.
This is your seventh tour, okay. And like... A lot of people kind of forget that. So I remember growing up and listening to Sarah, and her dad was in the army as well. And we've spoken to, Jesus, a super talent, super impressive family. Both Sarah, John, and yourself on the podcast.
Well, anyway. I just tagged on.
Yeah.
As an in-law.
Run out of guests. Sarah, I always remember Sarah growing up and her dad going off on tour, right? And being in a world where people would then say, when it was your turn and you guys were together and you were married and stuff, going off on tour, that people would say to Sarah, oh, sure, you must be used to it by now, right? And that always kind of grated me, because it's like, how do you get used to saying goodbye to somebody you care about and that you love? Like,
and you can't. Yeah.
Could you maybe talk to that a couple of times? Because you've done it now, not only seven times for tour, but you've done it in between when you've come back to go away, to come back, you've done it multiple times. Like what's that feeling like? Or like what's the motivating factor behind it?
So like, I suppose it's the cornerstone of everything that, when I say I mean I in the widest possible terms of every soldier, sailor, an airman or air person who goes overseas with the Irish Defence Forces. It is that element of service that you are signing up. I suppose it's the want to do more. You know, it's that element of like, to go back to the old JFK thing, like, you know, ask not what you what your country can do for you. It's kind of, you want to give that little bit more, and you accept it as part of that service. And you accept, like, for the good and the bad, you know, it's great camaraderie, you know, great experiences, but there can be a lot of difficult moments both overseas and at home, like, because you have to remember that, like, when we deploy, you have a period of pre-deployment training beforehand. So depending where geographically you are in Ireland, that could be another 2 months added onto a tour where you're not going to get home in the evenings because you're based in a unit that's too far away. So as the in the rank that I'm in, like I've basically, look over my career, I'm kind of averaging a tour every 3 years. Some have been shorter, some have been a bit longer. But it's something that it gets more complex as the more senior or longer you're getting or in service. Because I went on my first tour to Liberia in 2005, just me, you know, nothing to worry about. Away you went and you did your job. And we can talk about that again, but that was probably the most rewarding tour, one of the most rewarding tours I've had. But when I think, like, my last five tours have happened being married and with children.
Yeah.
You know, so, and it gets more difficult every time because you have this idea, look, it's part of the job, everyone gets it. You don't get it. Like, you're leaving a family behind, you're leaving a best friend and a partner behind. And people say that, like, oh, look, you know, it must be very difficult for Brian being overseas. And I suppose the way I always look at things is in a quite compartmentalized way. Like, I'm here to do a job. And I go on to what later on when we're talking about kind of some of the leadership things that I've learned. But, like, I can't control what happens at home. I can control what happens here. So that's what I control. That's what I focus on. But I can't help when Sarah rings me and says, the washing machine is broken. You know, and all that is adding another layer of stress to what we're leaving behind. And I think that's one thing that everyone, or a lot of people, really don't take for granted. I really don't appreciate the stresses that the family members of service personnel have at home. That, like, I have two beautiful children, but they're still two human beings in a house that need to be fed, watered, entertained, disciplined. And the most I can do is, now, we'll talk about the first tour now, but when I think now, the drop of a hat, I can WhatsApp a video call. But you can't replace that face-to-face interaction, like, you know.
Of course not, yeah. And how do you think the girls do when you are heading on tour? How do you think they take it?
This is the most difficult tour I've gone on, without a shadow of a doubt, emotionally. Because the girls are that bit older now, they're 10 and 9, 10 and a half, sorry, that's very important, 10 and a half and 9. But they're that more, they're maturing that bit more emotionally. Like when you think my first tour that they can remember was 2016, and it was actually to this mission as well. And they knew with the time difference, I could WhatsApp in the morning when they're going to school and the same in the evening. Whereas now they're a lot better, are a lot able to articulate the feelings. And it is really difficult. Well, like when a child tells you like that they're going to really miss you, and you can kind of go, ah, look, it'll be fine. But it gets difficult. You have to steel yourself that little bit, and it can be quite cold. Like I'm speaking from personal perspective here, but when I go, like there's a certain point that you have to kind of make the switch, because like the walls are covered, all my lockers are covered here with pictures of the family that keep you going, but you have to make that break. And the same, Sarah would say the same, you know, you need to go and just be gone to start the process, the counting down to when you're back, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Like you kind of, you're giving me kind of little shivers here as well, because you do have to make that switch, don't you? I know from being able to be around the girls while you're gone, right? You can see how much they miss your company and how much they miss kind of the messing and the laughing and the banter and both, not only like the two girls, but also Sarah, right? But Sarah's brilliant at being able to kind of go, right, as soon as he's gone, he'll start his trip back, basically. And maybe let's talk about it a little bit. So we might get onto it a little bit more, but like you've described kind of a couple of tours there, and wouldn't mind if you kind of maybe talk about what has been probably your biggest challenge, either in work or in life. And I'm wondering, is the job part of that, or is it more of a personal piece?
So I'll deal with the second half first. Absolutely, the job is part of it, because it's not quite a vocation, but you make a commitment to the state. And I'm not trying to egg it up to say we're all just soldiers and we do a job and we go home. We do, but there's a lot more asked of your job in uniform than there might be working for another company that's maybe a 9-to-5. So I've been very fortunate with my postings, geographically speaking. Like I've all been within reach of getting home. But there's also the risk that like you serve the state. It's not the other way around. So like when it comes to postings, there is a chance. And it is something that it's not quite lucky dip that you're pulled out of a hat and away you go. But there is that thing in the background that, like you could be posted to up to Donegal or down to Cork. You know what I mean? Now, it's not quite, as I said, black and white as that. But you do more as part of your job, I think, and you carry it a lot more, because when you look at our duties, various security duties, 24 hours a day, 365 in the state, there's always people on, there's always people resting off. It's trying to integrate that into your lives then, like not all your weekends are your own. You know, if you're on exercise, you could be gone for a prolonged period of time. So it kind of requires a buy-in from everyone in the family unit, that they understand that this is part of the job. You know, it's not a case of, you know, and we've had the conversation like that. He has to go. He'd be back in a week or he'd be back in 2 weeks. And that's just the way it is. The organization is amazing. Like, you know, if talking out to anyone who has any interest in joining, like it's a fantastic organization that does huge amounts of give and take, you know. Yeah. So it's not all doom and gloom, like, you know. But So that's obviously a challenge. Like straight away, if you're based away from home, as I said, luckily that hasn't been a major one for me. So I haven't had to deal with that one quite yet.
Sorry to cut across you there, but it's funny you say it hasn't been a major one for you. And yes, you're gone 7 times. You're gone for a year. You know, like and like to anybody else, like to be away from my family for a year. Maybe some people might like that, but in saying that, to be away, like you're still seeing the kind of the. This is part and parcel of the family unit, as you call it. It's everybody's bought into this now. So it's like, okay, I'm still lucky. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. But like when you look at, say, challenges wise, like I always have to go back to my first tour, like as a brand new commissioned lieutenant being sent to CR to Liberia and Sierra Leone as a platoon commander, you know, was massively daunting for me. You know, again, it's
So sorry to cut across you, Brian. Sorry, but like, can you maybe explain, because some people won't know the kind of the, some of the detail, like a platoon commander, what does that mean?
Sorry, yeah.
You know, because I'm sure there's a lot of it that just comes supernatural to you, but I'm there going,
and it's probably a fault on my end. I should probably explain that a bit more. So yeah, like when I, in 2005, I was commissioned in 2003, had finished my college in Galway, went back to my unit, I was on the list for deployed overseas missions. I got picked up to go to Liberia, which was a peace enforcement mission. So traditional peacekeeping is you party A, party B, and party C are the peacekeepers in the middle separating. Peace enforcement is a lot more strenuous. It's where there's no functioning government or no functioning parties to an agreement for peace. So we were a UN mission on this one. We had the mandate to enforce a peace in order to get to a point where you could have parties A or B and have a peaceful ending. And actually the mission to Liberia is still classed as the world's only successful peacekeeping mission, as it went from full-on war fighting to complete peace, and they've had a number of democratic elections in the last 8 or 9 years. So when I got picked up to go in the corps that I'm in, so the breakdown, the army's made up into different corps, I'm an infantry officer. Infantry would be the atypical soldier you think of, a guy with a rifle and a backpack. They're the backbone of all armies. So as a lieutenant, you know, you're brought in as a platoon commander. So platoon is basically the guts of 30 people. And you're landed in as, I was what, 23 going over with a platoon of 30. And from a challenge point of view, and this is all retrospective, of course, at the time you deal with the problems that you're facing, and you kind of live in that 1 meter world around you and you deal with what's happening at the time. But it's more when you have that chance to kind of do a bit of self-analysis and look back and kind of go, look, I arrived in there, all the NCOs, the non-commissioned officers, the guys like the sergeants, who'd be he'd be my second in command. And again, the old phrase, the sergeants are the backbone of the army. But all of these guys had multiple tours overseas. You know, some of them had tours to Lebanon when we've lost people, you know, and they've been very kinetic tours. And then here comes me as the platoon commander to I actually went with the 12th Infantry Battalion based in Limerick. I'd never met any of these people before in my life before I started doing our form of training. So it was the challenges for me were, it was kind of bringing it from the book of learning of the cadet school, you know, that this is what it says in the manual and this is what you do, versus, you know, we'd go on 2 week jungle patrols up to the Guinean border, the Sierra Leone border, the Ivory Coast border for 2 weeks, just your platoon.
Wow.
You know, and I had a couple of hairy moments on that tour where the country was just finished full on civil war, as in neighboring civil war into Sierra Leone as well. The war officially had ended, as in parties, all the groups had come together and say no more civil war. But all those groups for the last 10 years have just been bandits. So now they're not rebels anymore. They just became criminals, you know. So you still were dealing with all these. You know, a lot of times you'd have child soldiers, teens, who, you know, they knew nothing else, so they just kept the criminality. And there were times when we had to go in and deal with this, especially up in some of the rubber plantations, where the government then was trying to take back its assets to get an economy going. But the rebels, some of these groups had just taken over, the criminal groups, and were selling it themselves. And there was a few times, I'll always remember my first time was when my platoon sergeant at the time turned around to me and said, "What do we do now, sir?" And it was that massive light bulb moment for me. It was like, oh my God.
And what I'm in charge. Was the option? Like,
you know what I mean?
What were your options?
Thankfully, we never had any made like firefights or anything. There was a couple of other hairy incidents. I won't get into them. But a few times, like you'd, as in how to approach a group of armed teenagers who are significantly under the influence of substances, you know? And when the senior guy in your platoon turns around to you and says, "I don't know what to do here. What do you think? What are we going to do now?" It was at that point I kind of meant to us, not just being what an officer meant, what an officer is, but what's what a leader is. And it's what our preconceived notions of leadership, sometimes that comes with age, you know, the older you are, the more of a leader you are. It's not that. It's your position in whatever organization you're working in. And it's happened to make the decisions. You've probably heard that phrase, like the loneliness of command, the loneliness of management. It doesn't matter if it's business or military. It is quite lonely when you've multiple eyes, both younger than you, as guys on their first tour, or you've got corporals and sergeants looking at you with multiple tours gone, you make the call. You know, so we had a couple of incidents to disarm some people and stuff like that, but it all worked out fine. But it was a huge wake-up moment for me from reading about leadership, being trained in leadership, to actually leading.
Yeah, because there's one thing about doing the theory, isn't it? But it's actually putting it into practice is a different beast, because
100%.
When you have to make a decision for so many people, especially, like, I think there's one thing in business where you're not saving lives, you know, whereas in certain businesses, right? But in your situation, you had lives to manage, to look after, and to, like, a decision that you were going to make could jeopardize lives, right? So,
yes.
So that for me is the ultimate form of, I suppose, stepping up to the mark. And like, I've never experienced that in terms of a life or death kind of situation. But how is that where, like, does all the elements of training that you've ever done, does that kind of nearly fall out the window a little bit? Or is it a case of, okay, trust the training?
Oh, 100%. Like, it's like that in a sporting parlance as well. Like, you know, you fall when things are under pressure, you fall back to the level of your training, you know. And that's, I can't say enough about the people who trained us in the cadet school, because you'd officers and NCOs who'd vast experience, you know, you from an academic point of view, but also operational. And not even operational overseas. It can be operational in units in Ireland, because we were, as cadets, we'd no experience, you know. But they're bringing the man management. The, like, you might read and say a quote by an ancient Greek, Thucydides, or someone on leadership, and this is blah 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 blah. That's great, and that can be part of your arsenal. But ultimately, you want to talk about, how do you deal with people? What makes soldiers tick? What decision making? Like, again, we've some very formal decision making process that we use as part of military operations, and it has its place as well. But when it comes down to it, it's learning as an individual how to deal with your subordinates. You know, and understanding, that's half the argument, actually, or half the battle, is understanding that there is a leader-follower relationship. And it's not based on being better than anyone because you have a different rank. It's understanding your role in the bigger organization and making that work.
Wow. Wow, it's mad you say that. So a theme that's coming through the different discussions that I'm having with people over the last number of weeks and months is that theme of, in order to succeed, you have to be kind, you have to be understanding, and you have to have empathy, right? And I think there's certain balances of both, and I think it depends in the situation, right? So you don't have to be kind when you're fucking life or death, right? You just got to understand the situation. But Damien Brown speaks very well on one of the Damien Brown method pieces, where he's like, you can journal all day and you can write all your feelings down in the world, but it's only until you're put into the experience, that's when you determine if you're going to succeed or not. And that's why he's very focused on, absolutely takes the journaling piece to an ultimate, but he's like, you have to put your body through the stress as well. So therefore the training that you did with the cadet school, like, if you hadn't done that, you wouldn't have been in the physical mental space to be able to make those decisions.
100%. And it's that ability. And there's, I remember reading a story from the Second World War now, from the British Army, but it stands perfectly usable as a quotation today. It's basically like, you can sit down and look at authoritarian leadership, laissez-faire leadership, transformation leadership, as this is all to do with being an army officer. But at the end of the day, your soldiers, you need to tell them, we're going on the left flank or we're going on the right flank. And you have to make that decision. And there's a time for discussion and there's a time for action. And it's having maybe the academic and study. That's where studying is hugely important. And I think for anyone, any professional, any person, every day is a school day. But anyone who's in a management or leadership position, you have to be constantly doing a bit of self-analysis, but also using historical examples, because it's all been done before.
Yeah.
But it's understanding, yes, I know what transformation leadership, and I can understand the personal needs and individuals of my follower and the hierarchical path. But ultimately, you need to tell someone, ultimately, you're saying you're fired. You know, well, if I wanted to do this with this leadership, so the decision has to be made. And for us, from an operation point of view, you could have a plethora of decisions every day overseas that just need a call.
Amazing, isn't it?
I'm probably dumbing it down a bit too much there, but that's
no, but it's not dumbing it down at all. It just shows as well that there's massive transferable skills from what you're doing and leading in terms of the army into the private sector, yeah, into the world of into another world. Yes. And the organizational skills that you've got and the kind of the wherewithal to go, yeah, a growth mindset is important in order to develop, but also you got to be able to make the decisions and back yourself. We do a thing in work where we bring people part, make them part of the process. But at the end of the day, the buck stops at us. And so we then take that information, apply it to a situation and then go with it and then bring them with us, you know, because we're the ones who are driving it. But it's interesting you talk about learning from the past, and because it's all been done before, it kind of leads me nicely into kind of the values and affirmations and stuff. Like a lot of people get them over the years and they live by them, and I've got my own. And as you know, Sarah gave me a lovely gift of it framed and stuff. But what values or affirmations do you live by? And if you have any, could you share them with us?
Well, to be honest, and I'm not speaking in a personal capacity here, but like the values that the Defence Forces have, I find hugely valuable for me. There's six of them. And just to go through them, we give respect, loyalty, selflessness, physical courage, moral courage, and integrity. What I like about those values is they should have the same impact on people, whether you're a brand new soldier or you're the chief of staff. Doesn't matter. You know, and it's something that the whole point of organization values is that it's shared by all in the organization. And every action you take should be backed up by those. And again, when you talk about transformation leadership, you know, it makes it a little bit easier if you're trying to identify what are the values of your subordinates. I say subordinates, followers, it doesn't matter. From a leadership point of view, is trying to identify what are the values. And if you come from an organization that has shared values, that makes that a little bit easier because it helps you then, I suppose, and I would be a huge fan of transformation leadership, as I've said about 40 times. But
I love that, though. Do you think the army has transformed over the 20 years that you've been involved?
Hugely.
Yeah.
Hugely. Yeah. You know, and it's not because, to be honest, I would say it's the younger generations that are joining. So you have the army I joined, you know, I joined the FCA in 97, joined the cadets 2001, you know, so we were in a very particular, you've got guys who've been serving, say, the 80s and 90s. Professionalism values, the way they operate, the way they look at things were wildly different. Like when you look at now, the education standard of the Irish population is very impressive across Europe. But when you look at the level of guys that we're getting in now and girls in all the services, Navy, the Naval Service, the Air Corps and the Army, and the education standard, but also the professionalism is huge. You know, so the fact that we even have identified values, and you would have had people saying, older soldiers, yeah, should that, but yeah, we believe that as well. But it's trying to integrate it. So like when you think as a recruit now or a cadet, you'll be getting training on the values and what they mean. And the earlier a member gets that, again, in a business or in the military, the more they can use that. Now, it can be used, I think, the way we've transformed is, you know, there have been leaders where you think in the army, you just do what you're told. It's not quite like that. Like that's where it goes back to the moral courage, that if you've got leadership, and that be officers or non-commissioned officers, the sergeants, of conducting themselves that isn't appropriate, there's all kinds of challenges now to rectify that as a subordinate. It's not a case of kind of look at your man over there, kind of do what I say, not what I do.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very much a 360. So 100% in the 20 years I've shared, I've seen it's improved in leaps and bounds.
And what do you think is next? Because like there's the work that I see you guys working so hard, and you've obviously so many pals in the army, and you work your ass off to essentially defend a country while we're in neutrality, right? But a neutral country. But like, God forbid anything happened in for whatever reason, you guys are there to step up to the mark. And like, I know that there's been documented reports of people coming to Ireland who are less savory than others.
Friendly forces.
you know, and using Ireland as a kind of like a haven because of the easy access. like, do you think it'll be a case that we'll maintain that neutrality, or do you think they'll, like, I'm not saying that we're going to go to war or anything like that, but do you think that Ireland is in a position to that it will maintain that neutrality, or because we're so good at talking and now creating the peace process and having going from a kind of a world of just fighting all the time to a world of narrative and discussion?
Yeah. Well, not to overtly sidestep that minefield. The good thing about being in my position is that, like, we are servants of the state, and everything you mentioned there is for government to decide. So, like, when we say, for us now, you'll see the commission on the defence, our defence force coming out. It's all good and so we want the army to do this. Government will decide what they want from us, and that then will set in train a number of things, whether it be capability development.
Okay. I would
see us, so, like, we shout from the rooftops and with great pride, like, we're huge, hugely pro-European. I can see us getting involved a lot more over there. But again, that's all at the policy. In the policy, our defence policy is evolving. So that's for government to decide. And what they decide then trickles down to us. And that's where we will develop going forward.
Fascinating. Yeah. Do you know what? See, and this is it. As a layman, I wouldn't get it, you know. So it
no, 100%.
But it makes it clearer. It makes it a lot clearer to me as well. It makes more sense then, obviously, and then decisions are made and we go from there. But
yeah,
let's move on a little bit. So I want to, in a world that you've lived in, all right, that you've kind of grown up with your dad and as a scout leader, and you mentioned he was from Cork. I know that rubbed off you very well, and I believe you're a strong Munster supporter. Is that correct?
Just have a look up here. Should tell you the old Leinster flag proudly on the wall.
But who has been the greatest influence in your life, and in what way?
I suppose not to give the cliched one, but it's probably, I would, like, from a personal point of view, I would say my dad. So my dad is a kind of industrial chemist by training. So science is his thing. But again, it's like everything with age, you know, you don't realize either that number one, you're turning into your dad, or you don't realize what they taught you. But it's all like, I probably credit my dad with it. It's that critical thinking of asking why, just that question, why? And, you know, and it's funny because as I began to do my professional training as an officer, so we have our junior command and staff course, which is as the kind of captain, mid-level officer rank. And it's training you for promotion, but we teach the military decision making process, MDMP. And as part of that, one of the best questions you can ask yourself at each step is, so what? So what? What does it, like, you hear something or you hear a problem? Well, so what does that, as in, what does it mean? You know, so my dad was teaching me to ask the why. Maths would never be my strong suit, you know. So I'd be sitting there, I was like, oh, this isn't working. Well, why? Why is it not? You know, and it's kind of giving you that the ability to critically think about things. And it's the same. You hear all the furore that's going on now with podcasts and stuff like that. People ask the so what, why, what does that mean? You know, educate yourself, find out what the problem is yourself, and be able to sit down and say, not accept something because you see it for the first time. And if it doesn't make sense, ask yourself, why does it not make sense? And go back, you know, and be able to methodically go through something. So I suppose I give him that and my absolute love of reading, you know. I like that, having a growth mindset and never stop trying to learn something new. Professionally then, I suppose a huge influence on me was actually the platoon commander for me in the cadet school, who's now Cathal Berry TD, the independent TD of Stoke Kildare. He was my instructor in the cadet school, and I suppose him and another number of officers, Keith Murphy was another one, he was a captain at the time. They shaped for me what it meant. And this is where I started my leadership journey. And again, I look at myself as just an average army officer doing his best. But when you start to look back and say, we all actually have leadership stories to tell. You know, we're not following the numbers. And so my first exposure would have been to both of those guys who actually said to me what it meant to be an officer, you know?
Yeah.
So I would have got across the first introduction to those values. Again, those values were only ideas back then. We had formulated into leadership doctrine. But to me, I would look back and that they were the guys who I first saw what it meant to embody our values.
Would you recommend it to a young person now, or to a person now to go into the army? Yeah. And if they,
absolutely.
Is there a certain value that you need, or if, is it a case of, so there's an unbelievable amount of discipline in being in the army, you know, and following certain rules and living up to certain standards, you know.
Yeah.
So obviously it's not for everybody, and you spoke about you need a good follower as well as a good leader, right?
And to be honest, to add on to that, to be a good leader, you need to be a good follower, in my opinion.
Okay, explain that.
Because I have a boss, you know what I mean? So I'm not the chief. I'm a major. A commandant is the Irish rank, and kind of NATO EU standards would be a major. But there are lieutenant colonels and colonels above me. So in order, you're not the top of the totem pole. So in order to lead, you need to be able to follow your boss or your commanding officer and carry out his or meet his objectives and carry out his orders while bringing your people with you. You know, yes. So I definitely think it's developed into a kind of a 360 style leadership that, you know, you're a peer to the people with you. You're a follower to your boss and you're a leader to the people under you. And you need to be able to kind of operate in that 3D space constantly. You don't pick and say, today I'm going to be a follower. You know?
Mad.
Unfortunately, yeah. It's not that simple.
But no, I know. And exactly. But people don't realize they're doing it. It becomes kind of sometimes part of parcel of the role, right? So like just going to that, back to say, like in your journey and your kind of life to date, then if you're looking back a little bit and maybe even looking at a message to share with your own kids or and potentially your younger you, the younger Brian, when he was starting off, yeah. Like in the journey, what message or what advice would you share with them now, knowing what you know?
About joining?
No, just in life in general.
It's a good question. I think it's having a growth mindset is probably number one, as in always try and learn more and expose yourself to new opportunities and new experiences, whether that be serving. And again, that's another conversation, which I think I certainly never had it as a child. You definitely, like, what does the state mean to you? Like, you know what I mean? What does being a citizen mean? You know, does that come with an expectation of service? You don't have to. There's no conscription in this country, but it's as a child and a young adult. Like, it's hard to believe now. My girls are almost preteens, like, you know. But understanding where you fit into the country, you know, what you want to do. We live in a phenomenal country that you can choose to be whatever you want, and work towards it. But I also think, like, it's not limiting yourself. You know, if there's nothing, like, it's not a case of, oh, I'm definitely not going to join the army. Like, some people think it's a life sentence. Like, you could join. There are people, look at every other army in the world. We've done it now the last number of years where we have people who can join. There's nothing wrong with you leaving after 5 years. You know, you would come out a much better rounded person if you were to join. You know, absolutely, you don't want to make your career. That's absolutely fine. We live in a free country. You come in, you've given a couple of years service to the state. You've got unbelievable leadership training, and it doesn't matter what rank you come in, you're going to get an opportunity to serve overseas. You know, so you're when you leave after a number of years, if you leave, you know, if you want to leave, you're bringing huge amounts of experience into civilian life. I think all those, and that goes back to outside the military. If you still have that mindset, that growth mindset, I think is the key for every individual development. In a way, I don't think there's nothing wrong with that. Like, there are people, you know, still don't know what the joke is. They still don't know what to be when I grow up, and you're in your 40s.
You never stop growing up.
But I think that's massively healthy.
Yeah.
You know, do one thing, and it goes back to that. We're probably going to talk about it at some stage. Is some of the stuff we've taken from history, from the likes of the Stoics, like that phrase "memento mori," like, remember you are going to die. It's not dark. It's not. It's just you will die. You have a set amount of time on this planet. So just, you know, like you've said, like you've often said it before, this is not a dress rehearsal. Just go and do what you want to do. And if you don't like it, do something else. I know that's massively
It takes bravery to do that.
Huge bravery. Yeah.
You know,
but again, it takes bravery because tied to a growth mindset from a young age.
Yeah, you know, true. Yeah.
A bit easier.
Because
how many people do we know who've had a 20-year career in a job they actually don't like?
Yeah. Well, you know, and
it's not saying it's their fault. It's maybe it's having the plan. I've identified it again. So what? I don't like this job. So what? Like,
yeah,
what
or and on a personal level, or being in a 20-year relationship, and they don't like,
yeah,
you know, and they've made all these different decisions because they feel that that's, well, I've made my bed, so that's it. I know there's a commitment and stuff, but also happiness is
life is too short.
super important for content in life. So, well, what's a great philosopher, Alan Watts, said, would you prefer to spend the rest of your life doing something that you hated, or would you, and knowing that you'd live forever, or do something that you loved, knowing that you had a limited amount of time?
Yeah.
And like, I know what the one I choose. So yeah, I think it is quite interesting. Talk to me about the various, if there's a book or a podcast or anything that you'd encourage somebody to look at or to read, because for me, I think you've touched on it. You love reading. You are you're the ultimate reader. And I remember one time you gave me a book and everything had been highlighted and like things had been labeled, and it was like the most organized book I've ever seen in my life. And I'm going, Jesus, I better actually use this. But like, and you also gave me a fantastic book called Daily Stoic, which I have here, right? And you have it there, right?
I have it here as well.
What date are we today? We are the
2nd of February.
2nd of February. Hold your horses there now.
So February is passions and emotions is what it deals with. Yeah, that's one I couldn't recommend highly enough to everyone.
So just on that, all right? The 2nd of February is called A Proper Frame of Mind. So the Daily Stoic is obviously a book that is obviously a book. Yes, it is a book. But it's a book that has 366 meditations on wisdom, perseverance, and the art of living. And so every day there's something new, right? But this is just a quote from Marcus Aurelius. Now, how fitting is that, right? How fitting is that for this? I didn't even realize this, right? So it says, frame your thoughts like this. You are an old person. You won't let yourself be enslaved by this any longer. No longer pulled like a puppet by every impulse. And you'll stop complaining about your present fortune or dreading the future. How good is that? Now, like that actually, I didn't even practice this, but like that's actually what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Don't and wait.
Thousands of years ago, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. What other books or things would you?
When I was thinking about this, I made a couple of notes here, like five, and I was kind of conscious. I suppose the books I've picked are quite military in nature, and again maybe because it's the uniqueness of what we're talking about, but the ones I've picked are hugely applicable to non-military, you know, because it just happens the topic may be military, but the lessons are applicable across all facets of society. Like, you
love
know
it. Yeah.
So there's one book called The Mission, The Men and Me by a guy called Pete Blaber. He was an officer in US Special Forces in a Delta Force. He wrote a phenomenal book about his experiences in special operations, but also the leadership tenets that he grew up with, and what is, again, he says he wanted his key sentence to be on the cover of the book, you know. So when he approaches any problem, mission first, then your troops or your subordinates, then yourself. And it ties into the old phrase, like, you know, leaders eat last. And it's something we still see today. Like, an officer would never go for grub before his troops have had food, and that's part and parcel of leadership. So that's one I'd hugely recommend. The next one is from, again, showing our age, there's a TV show, Band of Brothers, is 20 years old.
Wow.
But just in case anyone hasn't seen it, HBO series based on a US airborne unit in the Second World War, and their platoon commander and then company commander, so their main leader is a guy called Major Dick Winters, Richard Winters. So Band of Brothers came out as a history book by Stephen Ambrose, American historian. But then Dick Winters himself wrote a book, and it's called Beyond the Band of Brothers. And it is phenomenal. Like, when you think it's looking back at his, and he was a major, he was the same kind of rank that I am. He wasn't like a 4-star general, but his leadership principles are some of the best and most grounded that I've ever read. And they would be applicable to sports people, business people, academic, it doesn't matter. It's a phenomenal book to read. And again, I actually picked one or two. I've a couple of leadership quotes that I've picked up along the way. One of them are from him. At the end of the book, he has a thing called, you know, 10 parts of leadership, or leadership at the point of a bayonet, and the stuff that he learned. And again, like, I think one thing that when you look at some of these military history stuff, you have to realize some of these guys fought for maximum 2-3 years. Like, they weren't, and then they left. They're citizen soldiers. So this guy, you know, joined in 42, finished 45, never served again, ever. So like it's but not
that, like the experiences that he went through in those years, like will stand for him or will stay with him for the rest of his life, right?
And so they directed his the rest of his life in business and into retirement, you know.
Yeah.
The third book then would be using a Henry V quote, "Steal My Soldier's Heart," by a guy called Colonel David Hackworth, one of the most highly decorated soldiers of all time. Joined as a 14-year-old. He lied about his age and joined the American Army in Trieste in Italy in 45 as a private. Retired as a lieutenant colonel, served in every leadership role all through the war in Korea, multiple tours in Vietnam. And this book is basically, he took over the worst unit in a region, like the worst for discipline, for operational effectiveness, absolutely useless. And it's the trials of him going in, and he transformed that unit into the best unit. Took some hard calls, he had to fire some people, but that's when his leadership was really put to the test. But I've read that book every time, actually, before I've gone overseas. I've read that book again and again and again and again. I think it's phenomenal. Based in Vietnam, but the leadership lessons are huge. Kind of historical fiction then would be my next one. It's a book called Gates of Fire by a guy called Stephen Pressfield, former Marine. But it's the book, one of the books that the movie 300 was based on. And he looks at it from a historical point of view of, you know, leadership under adversity and the challenges of leadership. Again, it's historical fiction. It's a great read, but it's an awesome book.
Yeah.
And the last one then is by I would say famous, but he's certainly one of my favorite strength coaches, a guy called Dan John. It's a book called Never Let Go. So he comes from a unique perspective of being a very high level discus thrower, shot putter, track and field athlete, coach, but also was teaching religious studies and philosophy. So he was a lot of his stuff, his writings are workouts, but that also come with stuff to do with mental resilience and asking yourself why, and like that, never let go. So his big thing is, like, and again, not to quit. That's his big thing, but that's a phenomenal book if anyone gets a chance.
Jesus, I'll get all the links and stuff off you.
Yeah,
and names and stuff. Send them on to me and I'll put them in the notes, because I think what's brilliant is that you've got such a diverse group of people and applying their experiences in leadership. Or I know the lads are in the army and those different guys have worked serving the army, but each one of them probably takes away something different that then you can take and apply to your own leadership skill, right? So, like, 100%. You're obviously a leader as well.
Look at Steal My Soldier's Heart. You know, he's a battalion commander going into all those military acronyms mean nothing. It's you're a manager going into a company that's performing terrible.
Yeah.
How do you turn it around? You know, it's nearly the military part in these books are nearly irrelevant.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
The military operations are a stressor, and it's how the leadership leader deals with those stressors.
Yes, I get you, because that's actually a really interesting way of putting it, isn't it? Because the military situations in the military that they found themselves in has then helped them apply their leadership or realize the type of leaders that they are, and then you apply it. So it's funny, like, I love these kind of conversations, because like I'm not great at reading in terms of the sitting down and picking up a book, but I love audiobooks. I love listening to them. So I'm sure there's plenty of that on audiobooks, right? Yeah. On Audible and stuff. So I'll send put all the links in the show notes. And how's that going, balancing working in Syria, a master's, and being away?
It's tough, but the reason I particularly chose studying over with Liverpool John Moores University is the fact that it's remote. You know, yes, and I've definitely found remote is great, but it puts all the pressure on you, as in, I'm not at home, and I go up to UCD or DCU on a Tuesday and a Thursday, and you go to Letter and you tip. They give you your assignments, and away you go, and you research. Yeah. You know, so in the job I'm in, like, I'd be in charge of all any protocol. So any visits to the area of operations here from New York or from different parties. So there's a lot going on. But again, look, it goes back to discipline and time management and kind of setting aside. The way I'm looking at it is, like, it's maybe 2 hours in the evening and then whatever extra bit I can do on the weekends.
What's the master's in?
I'm doing it in intelligence and security.
Jeez, unreal. My God. Our very own fucking James Bond. So come here, listen, the mic is yours. At the end of every podcast, they always say, listen, if people want to get in touch or if they want to reach out or learn a bit more, or indeed if people want to get in touch with you about the army and stuff, like tell people what's going on in your life, tell people what you're interested in, what the future holds.
That's a good question. What does the future hold? I suppose now I'm focused on looking where I'm going to get posted when I get home. I don't know yet. I don't know that yet. So that's the next challenge. For me, I would hopefully this, you know, be able to take a break from overseas service for a while and get posted somewhere at home and kind of get stuck in there and kind of reestablish normal, the normal family life that we all know and love. Apart from that, I don't know, and I kind of like that. I don't know I don't know what the future holds. You know, at the age, as I said, of 20 years done now, who knows what the next 5 years? I really don't know. Not the answer you're looking for, but
no, do you know what? And that's fine. Like it's actually fine not to know, because none of us know what the future holds. But I think the fact of the matter is, as you said it earlier on, is you control the controllables, right? You're looking after the things that you can do every day to make you as good as you can be, both in a professional world and in a personal world. And I think it was great to hear your stories, Brian, and I loved like just kind of getting you on this, making you a little bit uncomfortable, but I think you flew through it. I think you're kind of relaxed as you got through it. But it's been super having you on.
It's both an Irish thing, you know, you don't have notions, but also if you talk to any soldier, like, you know, like it's only when you start talking like this, we've so vast experiences that I've accrued in 20 years. But like, and like I'll openly say to it, when you asked me to come on, I was like, sure. No one wants to hear me. Like, who am I? I'm only a randomer. Like, you know what I mean? And maybe we don't do it enough. Maybe that's a fault of ours that we don't sell it enough.
Actually, that's something else I forgot to ask you as well. And I know we're kind of coming to the end and stuff, but what's the challenges for mental health within the army, and the challenges of sharing the stories and kind of the making sure that people don't kind of go down any kind of rabbit holes and feel alone? Like is that something that is heightened?
It can be, but like what I will say is that like we say like we are Ireland, you know, the army and the defense force. I say army, I'm an army officer, but the wider defense forces, we are a cross section of society. You know, we are citizens of Ireland who've decided to serve. We face the same challenges as everyone else. On top, then we have obviously the stressors that overseas, that not even overseas, the military service, because you can be exposed. And me and a lot of other colleagues have been exposed to quite sensitive things that, you know, that you will remember forever, and then maybe not in a good way. And that's maybe some stories for another time. But
how do you deal with that?
So like, first off, like the personnel support services that we have in the Defence Force are fantastic. You know, so for example, when you deploy overseas, you get pre-briefings about coping with stressors, normal stress, as like we've talked about, how to cope on a first tour, being away from loved ones, partners, children's businesses, you know, family members. But also we've constant 24-hour access to support services anywhere in the world. So all of the Irish missions have contact with people in Ireland. And I definitely think no more than Ireland in general, like the stigma has changed. You know, that it's okay to be not okay, you know, and it's getting rid of that, maybe that overly machismo that you might expect, like, you know, the strong silent type is nonsense. It's, you know, a warrior and a leader, and that's every rank, has to be able to analyze himself. You know what I mean? If you're not able or willing to deal with like all you're doing, I would look at it, is putting others at risk. So you're nearly, if you wanted to help you that way, you'd be going, I'm actually doing this to help my buddies. And that could be the start of you dealing with stuff. But yeah, from a, we've come on leaps and bounds, when it comes to stress management.
It's actually interesting to say that, because if you're not looking after yourself, you're putting others at risk. And we spoke earlier.
Like from day one, like I don't know how many push-ups I've done, how many star jumps I've done. Shouting, I'm waiting for my buddy, like, you know, or if I did something wrong, so you'd always be paired off with somebody. Like you'd often see it, like in some of the SEAL movies, they talk about it, like a swim buddy. Ours is just, we just call it the buddy. Everyone in your squad of a section, we would call it, let's say of 9 or 10 or 12 or the platoon, everyone would have someone assigned. So in our accommodation block, the guy who lived across from me was my buddy. And what happened to him happened to me. So if his room wasn't up to standard, I got it in the neck as well. and vice versa. If he dropped his rifle, I got it in the neck. And I thought that.
But I think.
And it goes back. That's an ancient thing. Like, you know what I mean? The guy standing beside you is.
Yeah, but I think it's even bigger again in that, because I'd be looking at that going, if you don't take time to look after yourself, then everyone else around you is affected, right?
Yeah.
So and then having the support mechanisms in place and having the confidence or the courage to talk and ask for help. And as you said, a good leader understands their followers or their team. And if they don't understand themselves, how can they even look to understand anybody else?
Yeah.
So I think in society as well, the same approach applies, right? So if you don't look after yourself, those who love you, who care for you, or who are interested in your life and your success and your livelihood, they suffer as well with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because absolutely. They want you to be okay, and they want you to help you. And I know it's not as simple and plain as that, but ultimately it goes back to having the tools in your arsenal to have the confidence to share, to tell the story, to talk, to be open.
Absolutely.
And to not be afraid, because, and I've quoted it a couple of times, Carl Rogers, and I got it off Caelan Dyers when I was talking to him, is that what's personal is universal. And that for me is so
absolutely.
True.
You know? I maybe if you'll indulge me for a few minutes, I suppose, is to go through. I could write 50, but I picked 9 kind of leadership things that I've learned. That, again, yes, they've held good stead for me in my 20 years, but they would be as applicable to people in the civilian world and the sporting world, etc. So, if you give me 2 minutes, I'll just go down through these one by one. Okay, so the first one, which is probably the keystone for me, is the standards you walk past are the standards you accept. So,
say that again, please.
You know. The standards that you walk past are the standards that you accept. So I would say, the way I would look at it, if you walk past someone and you see them, like even dropping litter, you know, and that's okay. That's just pick that out of the top of my head now. You don't do anything. You're saying that's okay. That's what I represent. Especially then, obviously, from a leadership point of view, if there are people under you or above you, by the way, this is where I'm going back to the 360. If you see actions that are not, you just say, that is not okay. And for us, for example, to really dumb it down is like our standards of dress, that whenever you're walking somewhere or wherever you're outdoors, you always wear a beret, always wear your headgear. And you might pass someone in a town or outside the barracks or even in the barracks who hasn't got it, and you don't call them on that, that now becomes your standard, because you'll guarantee someone's watching.
Accountability.
Or someone is looking at you, like, you know. So the standards you walk past are the standards you accept. That's number one. Number two, bad news doesn't get better with age. So from a problem-solving point of view, a bad news an hour ago is still bad news now. You know, it's not. To be honest, all you're probably doing is compounding it and making it worse. So the quicker you can share a problem with someone, and that goes back to mental health as well. You know, the quicker you can share that, the quicker you can solve. And it goes back to the old parents, you know, like the problem shared is a problem halved. And that can be business or personal. That's what in my opinion.
Love that one.
Then from a leadership point of view, and I suppose it's the gritty edge of leadership that maybe we would concentrate on sometimes more than outside in the civilian world, but like in interpersonal relationships are extremely important. But the way I would phrase it is your troops don't need another friend, they need a leader. Because I've seen people with the best of intentions, and it goes back to, there's a great one in that, actually, Steal My Soldier's Heart. And the last chapter of that book is his key takeaways. And he mentions one thing, the difference between a nice guy and a good man. Now, again, bearing in mind it was a good woman as well. It's based in the 60s. The nice guy let fellas bring a radio on patrol, or the nice guy let the lads take shelter in a house when it was raining. But the good guy did what had to be done. You know what I mean? Because ultimately, being a nice guy can have very negative implications. Yeah. A point that you made there, leaders need downtime too. So this is stuff I've had told to me overseas, or I've given to some people. And that one from my last tour here was a reminder to some of the new officers, is that like you have to have some downtime as well. You have to have a plan for your own headspace. One that I found very important is delegate and empower your subordinates, because that's how both parties grow.
Love it. You know, nice. Yes.
Nothing worse than a micromanager leader. Oh, what's the point then? Like, you know,
we've all had them.
We've all had that, like, you know what I mean? Getting wrapped around the axle in the weeds you know, you need to empower your subordinates because that's how they develop into superiors. Be humble is another one. So for us, from everything we strive towards from an operational point of view is like achieving mission accomplishment. But the goal is, regardless of the task, is achieving mission accomplishment. And what I mean by be humble, this would be one from Dick Winters, is that it doesn't matter who gets the credit. You know, that there are too many leaders looking for that credit. It's where it's having that ability to step back and just let, if there's praise coming, let it come. It's not to you, it's to everyone. And have that ability to kind of sidestep and not make a big deal out of it either. But to understand that if someone else gets thanked, you know, it doesn't matter. It's all part of aiming towards that mission accomplishment or in business part of, you know, just achieving our objectives. Lead from the front. I'm supposed to be a leader of character. And it's not, that's where we go back to do what I do. You know, it doesn't have to be from a military point of view. Like we would say, you know, the Americans have in their infantry school, it's a picture of an officer saying, follow me. You know, but that's, in a way, that is what you're asking me to do. So it doesn't matter if you're implementing a new policy on whatever in your business, that you're seen to be embracing it and not just bottling other people for not doing it. Like, you know, a great one again from Dick Winters is self-analysis, the bathroom mirror check, he calls it. That before you go to bed, kind of look at yourself in the mirror and kind of have that moment and go, look, did I do my best today?
Yeah. The
answer should always be no. Like,
I will, but like, I think there's also a point of saying, am I proud of what I tried today, or proud of giving today my best shot? And if you can say I'm proud of it, then great. And if you can't, then it's like, okay, what would I do differently tomorrow?
Exactly. And it takes 20 seconds and you can be very honest with yourself because there's no one else there. Like, you know, and kind of have that few minutes of looking inwards and moving on. And the last one is one of my favorite ones you've mentioned already, is that control the controllables.
Love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Now listen, Brian, you're an absolute gem. I appreciate you coming on, pal. This has been...
That was great, man. Thanks for having me on. It was awesome.
It's great. You know, this is what it's all about, learning from people who are like you and me. And I've no doubt people took stuff from that. Like, there's so much in there. You're going to give me a great job trying to do the promo pieces now. But I appreciate it, pal. I really, really do. And you're a super friend. Really, really top guy. You've been there for me through thick and thin. you've seen my best and my worst attributes. So I appreciate everything you've done, and I appreciate you coming on, pal.
You too, brother. Thanks a million for having me.